I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some new economic numbers are out today. Consumer confidence is up more than expected, but still well below levels that would indicate a healthy economy. Home prices went up a tiny bit in November, but still 30% below their peak. And the big one, the federal deficit for this year, drumroll, $1.35 trillion. That's according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. It's a slight improvement over last year, but what if you could chip $10 or $15 billion off of that? That's what the White House is proposing. In his State of the Union address tomorrow night, President Obama will reportedly propose a 3-year spending freeze on some domestic programs and, well, no good deed goes unpunished, as we'll hear. Wall Street Journal columnist David Widener joins us. And David, before we get to reaction to the president's proposed budget freeze, the Senate just rejected a plan to create a bipartisan panel to take on the budget deficit. It was a plan the president backed, but we understand Democrats and Republicans were leery of it because they felt it gave this panel too much power. They're floating around the idea of a panel that would give them a little more wiggle room, the ability to amend it. But your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think that certainly the way the panel was structured and its flexibility was an issue, but I think it comes down to, as you mentioned, a philosophical divide about how they should tackle the deficit problem. And basically, a lot of the Democrats and more liberal senators worry about benefit cuts. They worry that this will stymie the economy. And on the other side of the aisle, the Republicans and more conservative senators are worried that about tax increases. That may be one of the results of the or one of the suggestions that the panel puts forward.
Right.
So there's and underlying all this is just the general election year worries of these lawmakers that they may they don't really want to go out there and take a stand in the middle of all this with elections looming.
Right. Well, to that spending freeze, with that in mind, again, on just some parts of the government, some people say it's largely symbolic. Others say, hey, $10, $15 billion, it's a start. But the sharpest criticism seems to be coming from liberal economists. Brad DeLong is calling the president Barack Herbert Hoover Obama. But then you have economists like Paul Krugman who say there has to be spending to get through the recession, as FDR ultimately did after Hoover tightened the reins. That's what that references to. So it seems like the president just can't win here.
Well, there are supporters of this. You know, on the global stage, there's so many. You look at Japan and China, the two big buyers of our debt. They've been leaning on the administration to get a grip on spending, and they really feel that spending in the U.S. is going to lead to deterioration of U.S. debt overseas and a lot of this debt, which they own. And so from that perspective, I think that this is a signal to them that from the White House that they are heeding at least their concerns, and they want to send the signal that spending will be curtailed. And the idea, you know, $10 or $15 billion a year, it's $250 billion over a decade, and
starts adding up.
Yeah, when you factor in that costs rise, that inflation is a factor, it's a pretty significant proposal.
Well, and again, a lot of programs we excluded: the military, Veterans Affairs, Homeland Security. They wouldn't be touched. Only domestic programs that are called discretionary spending, and Republicans are mocking it, some saying that it's like going on a diet after winning the pie-eating contest. Have Republicans succeeded in making Americans forget that the first stimulus spending came under the Bush administration?
That's a great question. I think right now there's a lot of scurrying to try to catch on to what they feel is the populist sentiment out there, and it's kind of like playing with fire. You see it with the confirmation right now debate over Ben Bernanke. Bernanke is a Republican who was appointed by a Republican, and right now I think there's a lot of confusion about who's responsible for what, and so in that sense they have been successful.
Yeah, that's Wall Street Journal columnist David Widener. And David, just in the few seconds we have, do you expect this budget bipartisan panel to resurface?
Well, you know, the president has talked about forming his own, but there's a difference when the Wall Street, when the White House creates a panel, it's immediately met with sort of this territorial dispute with Congress. When Congress creates its own panel, the suggestions or the recommendations, they could be identical as what the White House suggests, but when it comes from the White House, there's a little bit more pushback.
All right. David Weiner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as part of its campaign against distracted driving, the Transportation Department today announced an immediate ban on text messaging by interstate truck and bus drivers while they're on the road. Research shows drivers who text behind the wheel on the highway take their eyes off the road for enough time to drive the length of an entire football field. No more texting, the Transportation Department says, for trucks and bus drivers. Well, according to a pediatrician we'll hear from in a few minutes, that makes it even more important that parents model good cell phone and texting behavior to their kids. Today we want to talk about texting within families, and we know many families can't afford it or would be appalled by it, but nearly a quarter of all kids aged 6 to 9 have their own cell phones, and when they get older, they text a lot. We did a story recently on research that showed that the average 6th or 7th grade student sends 1,321 text messages per month, roughly 43 a day. And we're noticing that a lot of those texts and sometimes instant messages come from inside the teenager's home, sent to mom or dad right in the next room, sometimes in the same room. Here's New York writer Adam Gopnik speaking on the public radio show The Moth about instant messaging his teenage son.
We would instant message each other and have a conversation about our days. And sometimes we'd actually be sitting on the same bed watching a hockey game together, instant messaging each other in total silence.
Well, let's hear from another parent joining us from Wisconsin, Ian Coxhead, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin. Hi, Ian.
Hi.
Ian has two teenage daughters. One of them joins us, his 16-year-old Ikey. Ikey's had her cell phone for about 4 years now. It's not a smartphone, so she doesn't go online, but she sure can text. Ikey, welcome to you as well.
Hi.
So, Ikey, tell me, do you text your parent in the home?
Sometimes. Sometimes I get a text about dinner being ready or something like that, yeah.
And, Ian, what about you? What do you text Ikey about?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just very functional stuff about picking her up from somewhere or the need to be somewhere at some time, that kind of thing. But then once in a while we have an interaction which has a bit more emotional content, I guess. And sometimes that's when she's at school and she's feeling low, she might send me a text during the day, or if something happened at school that she wants to share with me, something funny.
Well, and we just heard about the father who messages his son about a hockey game while they sit at home and watch it. And this is the same parent who thought LOL meant lots of love.
Really?
Instead of laugh out loud. I know. I thought that too for a while, so I'd text my nieces and nephews and say, can't wait to see you, LOL.
My mom thinks that, so it's okay.
Well, so, I mean, do you agree that it sounds like you do, that it's a useful parenting tool?
Well, it's a useful means of communication. I'm not sure how useful it is as a parenting tool relative to other things. This is relatively new for American teens, but before they were texting, they were using other electronic means to communicate with each other. And my daughters in particular started out communicating with their friends through AIM and other chat-based media on computers.
Instant messaging and such.
Yeah, computer-based instant messaging. And relative to that, I like this a whole lot better. Basically, they're only texting, almost always texting with people that they know. I mean, they have to get a number from somewhere, or someone has to get their number. So there's a lot less kind of random interaction. And the other thing is that, you know, it's kind of go with the flow. Everyone their age has it, almost everyone their age has a phone and uses it to text, and that's how they communicate with each other. And we like them to stay in touch, so that's good.
Well, do you have any kinds of rules about texting?
That really depends. Like, if I get in trouble, sometimes my texting will get turned off for like a day or two or something like that. And I think my sister has restrictions because you can like change the hours in which someone can receive and send texts. So my sister's, I think, is turned off for a couple hours at night.
So Ian, you obviously feel it's important to have some boundaries.
Yeah, although we're very reluctant to place these kind of physical boundaries on texting because it is such an important means of communication. I mean, when we do it, it has a huge impact, so we have to use it very carefully.
Right. Well, you've said some of the times that you might text each other. Some of them sound, you know, pretty reasonable, you telling a child when you're going to be able to pick them up at school. But by the way, why couldn't you just call them?
I mean, you could, but texting is so much faster.
No, they never pick up when I call. They answer text within a few seconds, but they never pick up the phone.
So do you think texting gives you more of a connection with your daughter than you might have?
I think so, because I can text my dad from school and tell him, like, one of my teacher's bad jokes or something, or, like, a good grade I got on a test, or a bad grade, you know. But it's just like I can communicate with him in the day, and I know that he's there, and I can reach him if I need to.
Well, and Dad, you know, some people are hearing that might say, texting during school? I mean,
wish you hadn't heard that.
But on the other hand, I mean, you know, it sort of brings the parent into the school experience.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
And you know, we also understand that some people who've looked at this say that it helps parents and teens spare the drama. Do you find that to be true?
Well, I feel that Aiki can say things to me in a text that she wouldn't say necessarily face-to-face. She denies this. But you know, sometimes if we have a disagreement about something, then she goes off to school or wherever, and a little bit later on I'll get a text that, you know, shows that she's been thinking about it and reflected on it and has something to say. And then I feel very special. And, of course, she says, that's not special. That's just the way I deal with everybody.
Yeah. Well, do you worry about how she deals with everybody? We understand there was a time when you took Aiki's phone to see who she was texting, to try to have the same a sense of her communications as you might have if she was at a computer and you could look at her Facebook or something.
Yeah, like any parent, if we're concerned about a child's behavior or who she's interacting with, and we have, you know, reasons to be concerned about that, then we would want to find out much more.
Aiki, how do you feel about that?
It was annoying, but reasonable, I suppose.
You know, when you're sending and receiving 150 to 200 texts a day, as my daughter does, then it's buzzing pretty continually. So I worry that it's hard to develop and sustain a train of thought, and I really get concerned about that. That's my major concern.
Well, that's a lot of texts a day now.
I used to text a lot more than I currently do. I just text, like, my boyfriend and my best friend. I text them a lot, but it's not that I'm texting, like, multiple people at once, really.
I get really irritated when I see the girls texting when I'm trying to talk to them, or you know, just around the table. That's just bad manners, and that's curable.
And how about the number a day? Would you ever think of asking her to cut down on them?
I think we try to influence our daughters to consider this technology as something that's it's there to help them communicate, not to dominate their lives. So we've considered putting, you know, not physical, but numerical limits on the number of texts that they send and receive per month, but we haven't done so. And I think as long as we don't think they are completely losing control of it, then that's okay.
That's Ian Coxhead, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin, but for our purposes today, the father of Aiki, a 16-year-old and avid texter. Thank you both for speaking to us about this.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And just ahead, Aiki's pediatrician, who sometimes sees patients and parents texting during an appointment. We're also hearing from listener Fernando Barrios, who writes that his babysitter and her siblings all communicate through texting, even when they're in the same room. We'd love to hear from you about this or anything. Go to hearnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or scroll down and leave a comment. Later today, the texting generation is about to learn about a 60s classic, Trout Fishing in America, about to be re-released. Text the kids. Let them know. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about family texting. We just heard from Dad Ian Coxhead and his 16-year-old daughter Aiki in Wisconsin. They think it's a parenting tool. Of course, we're well aware. A lot of people, you know, don't even have cell phones. But we now turn to Aiki's pediatrician, Dr. Megan Moreno, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin. And Dr. Moreno, we just heard Aiki and Ian talking about texting maybe 200 text messages a day.
That's probably pretty consistent with what we hear all over in clinic and in classes, and that's pretty consistent with, I would say, what a lot of adolescents are doing right now.
Wow. Is that, I mean, I'm trying to do some math here. Is that more interactions than they might have had back in the day just passing someone in the hall?
I think it's hard to say because it's similar to many other forms of communication that adolescents have used in the past. I think if we look back in the 80s and 90s and tried to count up how many hours a day teens spent on the phone or passing notes in class, how many notes were passed per class is probably has some similarities in crossover in how much time is spent in texting.
Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts as a pediatrician? I'm not going to say concerns to label them that right away, but do you have concerns?
I think that texting is a tool, and like any other tool we use, it has benefits as well as risks. And I think that the conversation we heard between Ian and Ikey showed some great examples of how to use it for benefit, and using it to keep in touch during the day, to let your parent or your teen know that you're thinking about them, to help use it to resolve conflicts. Those are all great uses of texting.
To help use it to talk within the home, which they mentioned it happens occasionally, but we're hearing stories about it happening a lot, that, you know, parents and kids texting each other from room to room.
Yeah, that is certainly something that's a little newer than what we have seen in the past with adolescent communication. But I think that framing it in the developmental stage that teens are in, and that parents really struggle with this time period, that it's really hard to have communication. There's a lot of developmental struggles going on for independence, and I think that texting, again, can be a useful tool, even used within the house, where parents can have conversations with teens that maybe they would have had a lot of trouble having without texting.
Well, and we've read some researchers say that texting can help parents achieve something called ambient intimacy, sort of a sense of a teenager's life, the ambience of a teenager's life, without, you know, intruding too much.
I think that's true. I think texting can also allow teens and parents to express emotion during a time that's very difficult to express emotion. So I can think of a patient I had that was extremely shy and always had trouble expressing emotion. And in the teenage years, it was even harder. And so texting was a way for him to text his dad or his mom to say, I had a bad day, or I'm really lonely, or even to say I love you, which is not always the easiest thing to say at that time point.
Even if it's I-L-V-U.
Yes, exactly.
We'll take it. But you know, and it also enables parents to communicate with kids in ways that would have been mortifying years ago. I'm thinking we read anecdotally about parents texting a daughter on a blind date, you know, and that suddenly becomes cool, whereas if they called during the blind date, that would have been just death. But we're wondering, too, is this getting close to this topic we did so many stories on a while back, helicopter parenting, you know, parents that are hovering too much?
Well, I think teens are probably the best ones to answer that. And most of what I hear in my clinic is that teens generally don't mind the texts from their parents, especially when they're things like reminders of I love you, or I'm thinking about you, or I hope you're doing okay, when there's not an expectation that the text is meant as a checkup on their whereabouts. It can be a nice way for parents and teens to stay in touch. I think when there are a lot of texts that are, tell me what you're doing now, okay, it's 2 minutes later, tell me what you're doing now, then that I think does feed into the helicopter parenting.
And this is new technology, but we mentioned some ongoing studies and concerns about young people in particular getting too involved with technology because their brains haven't developed yet. There's whole schools of thinking, whole schools. So the Waldorf School, for instance, doesn't like its students to have technology too early. Do you have concerns about that?
Well, I think that a lot of the concerns were well addressed by what Ian mentioned in terms of having uninterrupted periods of thought, and especially during brain development, where teens or younger kids in particular have time that's quiet, where they can think about things, where they can process through the events of their day, they can process through how they're feeling, they can have some internal thought processing, emotion processing, without their phone beeping every 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And you see it in adults as well. You see adults who put themselves on email blocks where they're only checking email twice a day because they realize that they went to work for 8 hours and didn't get a thing done except for keeping up with their email.
I've seen whole families in airports. Every single person's on their cell phone, talking to each other.
Or at a restaurant. And you...
Yeah.
Well, in our clinic, if my patient starts texting and gets into it, I just say, I'll be back soon, and I just leave the room because I'm not going to sit there while they text. it's not a good use of their time or mine, and I feel like people need to learn those limits of this is not appropriate. But again, I think what Ian and Ike talked about is having some rules in your family for when you're going to interact face-to-face. So no texting at dinner time. I think,
and not just kids, but parents.
Oh, exactly. I think in some senses, some of what I see in clinic is actually worse behavior by the parents than the teens, where if I'm talking to a parent and their son or daughter, quite often it's the parent who's texting rather than the teen. So I think, in a sense, one challenge that we have is, as parents, being good role models to our children in terms of what is an acceptable way to integrate texting into our communication styles without having it dominate.
That's Dr. Megan Moreno. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin. Dr. Moreno, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In France today, a parliamentary panel is recommending that Islamic face veils be banned in public places, hospitals, schools, government offices, and on public transportation, most public places. The panel also says that anyone showing such visible signs of radical religious practice should be refused residence cards or citizenship. The conclusions follow President Sarkozy's comments last summer that burqas imprison women and should not be tolerated. The report also comes as France debates what makes a person French. BBC reporter Dominic Hughes is in Paris. Dominic, describe the veils the panel's talking about.
Well, in France, they refer to them as burqas, but in fact, the burqa is the full face veil often seen, for example, in places like Afghanistan, where there will just be a grill across the eyes. But in fact, that's not what the French women who are wearing veils are wearing. They're wearing something slightly different called a niqab, which is a full-face veil again, but there might be a slit for the eyes or a little bit of cloth over the eyes, but it's not like one of those full burqas that you might listeners might be familiar
right.
with from pictures in Afghanistan. But I should say, in fact, it's a very small number. Out of more than 5 million Muslims who live in France, which makes them the largest sort of Islamic minority in Europe, only around 1,900 women in France wear these full-face veils, and that's according to the Interior Ministry. But nonetheless, that has been enough to spark concern amongst politicians who see this as a rising trend. People say 2 decades ago you never saw anyone wearing a full-face veil.
Well, the French lawmakers who delivered their report today said all of France is saying no to the veil. So tell us about public opinion. First of all, why are people against it? And then for those who are concerned about the ban, why are they concerned?
Well, I think to start with, many people, and it's true, I think, to say that there is a consensus amongst the French that they don't like this full-face veil. They feel it is an affront to the values, the secular values of the French Republic. They feel there's something cultural about being able to see somebody's face. And also they are uncomfortable, I think, with overt displays of religion. So, for example, a few years ago, they banned head veils in public places like schools, for example. And they felt that that was an affront to the secular values of the French Republic. And I think the same applies here. But also there is this cultural thing about being able to see someone's
right.
face and being able to actually communicate with them that way.
Well, and for people who are concerned about the proposed ban, what are their concerns?
I think their concerns focus very much on the effect that any of these laws might have on the women themselves, that it might mean that they become imprisoned in their houses, and therefore it's affecting their human rights. And also, I think there were calls for much tougher series of proposals, which would have seen the veil, the full-face veil, banned everywhere, even in the street. And I think some people were concerned that that just wouldn't be constitutional. It would run into constitutional difficulties in the French courts.
Well, by the way, Dominic, I want to ask about the rest of the panel's recommendations that people showing visible signs of radical religious practice would be refused citizenship. What other signs of radical religious practice might that cover?
Well, I think it refers very directly to the veil, in fact.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what they're referring to. So they're saying that anyone who turns up at a government office looking for a visa, for example, would be refused that visa if they were wearing a veil.
Right. Well, so what's next? This was a proposal.
Yeah, this is a proposal by a cross-party committee of 32 MPs. It runs to around 200 pages long, so it's a pretty comprehensive work. Now, it's expected that it will probably lead to legislation somewhere down the line. There's no timetable for that at the moment. But I should say that the parties themselves, all the parties, seem to be split. The UMP, the ruling party of President Nicolas Sarkozy, many of his MPs would like to have seen the measures go much further. Some of the socialist MPs, the opposition MPs, are in favour of a ban, but some of them are also against the ban. So we'll have to watch and see exactly what form the legislation takes, whether it's tougher or slightly weaker.
The BBC's Dominic Hughes in Paris talking about today's government panel report calling for at least a partial ban on the public use of Islamic face veils. Dominic, thanks so much.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
Okay, when we come back, could the world's next real estate bubble be in Pakistan? Also, raise your hand if you remember Trout Fishing in America, not the activity, the book. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Land available, great location, walk to ocean. Also, home to local separatist movement and visiting Taliban leaders. That aptly describes land in the Pakistani town of Gwadar, which was a sleepy fishing village until Pakistan, in cooperation with China, decided to turn it into a major port, putting it on real estate maps as well as strategic graphs in the Pentagon, the Kremlin, in New Delhi and Tehran. But the province in which Gwadar sits, Baluchistan, is home to a separatist movement and Afghan Taliban leader Mullah Omar. Shahan Mufti, who's covered Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor, was seduced by the notion of owning a home on the sea. He responded to an ad and joins us with his tale. Shahan, Baluchistan shares a border with Afghanistan and Iran, and as we said, the popular leader of the Baluchi independence movement was killed 4 years ago. Didn't that give you pause?
Oh, sure. It was actually that part is part of the story, the death of Nawab Bukhti, the Balochi separatist leader in 2006. And that really was a turning point for Gwadar as well, as I found out. But yes, this place is locked between Afghanistan, Iran, the tribal areas. Then there's the Arabian Sea to the south. Even the brochures, which had beautiful pictures, which were photoshopped from other brochures of Hong Kong, Dubai, blatantly plagiarized. Part of the sell was, oh, there will be a highway connecting to Kabul in a few years, and that the Chinese are building this port there. All this geopolitics of it was actually part of the sales pitch that these real estate brokers were making.
And so what did you see when you got there?
Well, when you land, that's when you realize that the brochures are photoshopped. There's no skyscrapers there yet. There's no developed coastline. But it's still, that place does have this history. So this is the region where Alexander's armies withdrew from South Asia while drawing back and lost most of his armies in this area. This is a place that was colonized by the Portuguese for a while, at least invaded by the Portuguese, and then there was a British invasion, and then there's all this history. And even the town of Gwadar till the late 1950s, 1958, I think, was actually part of Voman. And you can still see a lot of that Arab influence there in the architecture. And when you land here, it does have this feel of a secluded, quiet coastal town, which is being promised as the future Dubai.
As you write, Arab sheikhs were buying pasture land for their horses. Thousands of people, including yourself, were flying in from around the world to gamble on real estate. But then there was this one moment as you got off the plane, your seatmate spat out something at you. Don't tell anyone you're from Lahore. So remind us of this other element. You are Punjabi, and there's been tension between Punjabis and Baluchis.
I was given that warning. That was the last warning I was given right before we landed. But I had been given this warning earlier as well, is that you are Punjabi. Punjabis constitute most of the army, armed forces. They have a lot of political clout. And compare that to the Balochis, who are very few in number in Pakistan, see themselves as a disenfranchised minority. And there is a lot of resentment. And then, of course, there's decades of history of in the 1970s, there was a brutal repression of the first Balochi separatist rising, and thousands of Balochis were killed by the Pakistan army then. And that was kind of repeated after the war on terror began in the region and all these great interests started colliding in the region, and former President Pervez Musharraf's army marched into Balochistan again in 2006 and, among other things, assassinated the leading Balochi political and separatist leader.
Yeah, that's the story we mentioned, Nawab Bukhti, and after that, there were people being slaughtered in the street, you know. So mm-hmm. it turned again into just a bloodbath. And so here you are coming to this region knowing that you are going to be viewed this way potentially by the Baluchi people.
What I well, wrongly assumed was that I am going in there not as a hostile force. I'm not going there as part of an army. I wasn't going there to loot land. I was going to buy land. I was going to pay a fair, good price. But that's what I found, is that land is touchy. And the people who've lived there and grown from that land, and, you know, a lot of Balochi see themselves attached to this land, that even if you are out there just as a business person or if you're going out to make a good buy, people tend to react when someone from the outside is there to take even just a little plot of land by
right.
the beach.
And one man made that joke that was sort of, you know, ha-ha. What did he say to you about a visa?
Yes, that is actually a joke that I heard from a few places. The question was whether one should buy land and go out there, because it doesn't all seem to be going very well, obviously, because there is this war, right, or it's surrounded by war. It, you know, there's a separatist movement. And so the question was, should one buy land? And a lot of people did respond with this joke. By the time that this town is developed, you just might need a visa to get here, which is a very ominous warning. It was said as a joke, but there is the sense that Balochistan is part of the theater of war right now, America's war in the region as well, and that no one knows what the future might hold.
Well, you tell us a little bit about another history, the Great Game, the sort of the Cold War that was played in this area, participants like the Soviet Union. And how, what did you conclude? It sounds like you came to the conclusion that you felt, as someone looking for, you know, just a little second home in the region, you might be a pawn in a new game.
That's true. I contrast my own trip. I sort of, you know, reflect it in another trip that a British general took to the region, into Gwadar, actually, and other parts of Balochistan in the 19th century. And he was coming in also to check out real estate, in a way. He had come in to check out telegraphic routes and just supply routes and all that, and he saw a lot of potential in Gwadar at that time. This is what historians call the Great Game, which was a contest between the British Empire in India and the Tsarist Russian Empire to the north. And Afghanistan and the Central Asian region, Balochistan, Afghanistan, is where this Great Game was being fought. But now, I mean, the game has evolved and the characters have changed, but a lot of theorists now are talking about a new Great Game. The characters now, of course, are the United States, Russia, and China. And the prize is... according to these, a lot of theorists say, the prize is the gas and natural resources that are coming out of the Caspian region. These are thought to be the next large reserves of gas, which are going to feed the growth in India and China. Pakistan, incidentally, falls right in the middle of all this.
So what'd you decide?
I did not buy land in Gwadar. To be honest, part of the problem is that the real estate boom is kind of, it's turning into a bust. It has been for a few years. Ever since Nawab Bukhti's assassination, the sentiment in Balochistan has really turned negative against the Pakistani government. But people are still hopeful there. The Chinese are obviously still developing the area. They're pouring in billions of dollars. But it's all very uncertain right now. It's not something I can afford with my limited resources yet.
Yeah. Shahan Mufti, he's covered Pakistan for the Christian Science Monitor and Global Post. His article on the city of Gwadar, which almost became his vacation, get away from home place, it's called Persian Gulf View. It appears in the February issue of Harper's Magazine. Shahan, thanks for taking us along.
Thank you, Robin.
The creek was made narrow by little green trees that grew too close together. The creek was like 12,845 telephone booths in a row with high Victorian ceilings and all the doors taken off and all the backs of the booths knocked out. Sometimes when I went fishing in there, I felt just like a telephone repairman, even though I did not look like one. I was only a kid covered with fishing tackle. But in some strange way, by going in there and catching a few trout, I kept the telephones in service. I was an asset to society.
That's the late Richard Brautigan, one of the counterculture's literary lions in the 60s, reading from his novel Trout Fishing in America. He was a shooting star, exploding with trout fishing in San Francisco in the Summer of Love. Poet Billy Collins was there, and Brautigan, he says, was easy to spot.
A very tall fellow who combined hippie dress, colorful shirts and beads with 19th century pioneer clothes, including a waistcoat and boots, all topped by an enormous beat-up Western hat. He looked like a man who had just stepped out of the same pre-industrial America whose passing he lamented in his fiction. Post-beatnik and pre-hippie, he was thought of as a rather mysterious figure, a man who didn't say much but was doing something very peculiar in his writing.
And that writing, like nothing he'd ever read before. Trout Fishing in America, Collins said at the time, was our Alice in Wonderland, and Brodigan, our Lewis Carroll, behind the best drugs in town. Trout Fishing in America is being re-released this Sunday to mark what would have been Brodigan's 75th birthday. Billy Collins, who went on to be the country's poet laureate from 2001 to 2003, has written the introduction to the re-release. He joins us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando, Florida, to remind us why this book was so important. Billy, welcome.
Thank you.
And you got to see Trout Fishing early on before it was published.
Yeah, there was. It was published in 1967, and in 1965 there was a bootlegged manuscript. And I'd heard about this, and I'd heard that this is a very peculiar book. And one day I was at someone's apartment sitting on the floor, as we did then, and they mentioned that they had this manuscript, and they wouldn't let me leave the apartment with it, but they said, if you want to sit down on the floor and read it, go ahead. So I read it, and I had never read anything quite like it. I was blinking when I finished it.
Try to explain why. I reread it, and it's sort of very realistic descriptions of creeks and fishing escapades smack up against completely hallucinogenic chapters on things like making walnut dressing. What is it about?
There are passages that sound like right out of Hemingway's Up in Michigan Fishing Stories, and he shuffles that together with, as you say, a kind of American surrealism, which is noted for its metaphoric wildness. I mean, as you just heard, I think he compares at one point a fishing creek to tens of thousands of phone booths.
Right.
And then he becomes the telephone repairman when he fishes there. He has to punch in and punch out. So it's this kind of kooky and zany and disruptive imagery, hallucinatory imagery, thrown into a kind of American pastoral setting. And the other feature of the book is that it messes with our idea of what a book is and how it should behave. This book, for example, Trout Fishing in America, is very aware of its own existence. It spends an entire chapter talking about its own cover. And this was before the rise of metafiction, which would be characterized by a kind of intense literary self-consciousness.
Well, again, what more did it mean? I mean, it was just it was a literary tour de force because it just shook you up so much, especially if you were in high school and reading Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And it seemed so present and modern and San Francisco. This was, you know, it was published in the Summer of Love. But you also say that he was writing about how the industrial world was intruding on the natural world at a time when that was kind of a new concept.
Well, indeed. I mean, ecology was just making its way into our vocabularies right then. And I think the underlying theme of the book, and, you know, once you go into literary criticism like this, you take all the fun away because the book, above all things, is just a tremendous free-for-all of verbal fun. But there are these collisions between the realms of nature and technology that you find in the book, climaxing probably in a chapter called The Cleveland Wrecking Yard, where you can actually go and buy a trout stream. $6.55 a foot is the price for the stream.
But as you said elsewhere, he writes just beautiful prose, and I think you have an example of that. Tom Martin Creek?
Yeah, there's a little passage that does sound very much like Hemingway. I'll just read a little passage.
Sure.
Tom Martin Creek was a small creek with cold, clear water and poured out of a canyon and through a culvert under a highway and then into Klamath. I dropped a fly in a small pool just below where the creek flowed out of the culvert and took a 9-inch trout. It was a good-looking fish and fought all over the top of the pool. Even though the creek was very small and poured out of a stream, a steep, brushy canyon filled with poison oak, I decided to follow the creek up a ways because I liked the feel and motion of the creek. I liked the name, too, Tom Martin Creek.
He also wrote poetry, and you, again, being the poet laureate, do you have one there that you can share with us?
Well, his poems are also, they're very simple. The feeling is, here's something that just flew into my head, and instead of ignoring it, like as most of you would do, I actually wrote it down on this napkin. I mean, here's a poem called I Lie Here in a Strange Girl's Apartment. I lie here in a strange girl's apartment. She has poison oak, a bad sunburn, and is unhappy. She moves about the place like distant gestures of solemn glass. She opens and closes things. She turns the water on and she turns the water off. All the sounds she makes are far away. They could be in a different city. It is dusk, and the people are staring out windows of that city. Their eyes are filled with the sounds of what she is doing. It's a very complex little poem because it's one thing to compare something far away to being in a different city. That's a straight metaphor. But once he says, it is dusk and people are staring out the windows of that city, we have gone inside the metaphor. You know, the terms of the metaphor have been reversed. Right. It gets you a little dizzy in the end, I think.
Right. Well, Billy Collins, what happened? You know, we know he killed himself in 1984, committed suicide, struggled with depression and alcoholism.
Well, I don't know. Who knows what happens? But I found it a piece of very shocking news. I really thought of him as his writing has a very sweet optimism about it. You know, there's also a kind of charming goofiness of his attitude toward life. And I don't know, my sense was if depression and drink can claim such a seemingly buoyant person, you know, what hope is there for the rest of us?
Well, near the end of your introduction to the re-release of Trout Fishing in America, you write, even though new readers of Brautigan may feel they've come late to the party, they might still enjoy a sense of discovery. And what would that be?
I think it still has, if not the power, at least the charm to make you sort of make the reader scratch his or her head as they're moving into the book, because the book keeps pulling these rugs out from under you. So this morphing inability of the book to stay still and behave like a book, I think, still is engaging.
Former poet laureate Billy Collins on Richard Brautigan's Trout Fishing in America. Billy wrote the introduction to it, as we said, and it gets a re-release this Sunday, the 75th anniversary of Brautigan's birth. Billy Collins, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we leave you with Richard Brautigan reading one of his poems, Love's Not the Way to Treat a Friend, recorded rather primitively in 1969 with the band Mad River.
Love's not the way to treat a friend. I don't want to see you end up that way, with your body being poured like wounded marble into the architecture of those who make bridges out of crippled birds.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Love's not the way to treat a friend. There are so many better things for you than to see your feelings sold as magic lanterns to somebody whose body casts no light.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.